Today we're going to talk with a professor who is an expert on Vietnam and who was an anti-war activist back in the 60s and 70s. And we will bring you that interview shortly. The opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. This is Dan Zhang with Subversity.
Boxes bare, teeth are ripped. Show your stomach you care, teeth are ripped. Pull the rib chest of a power effect to shame. Swelling out the problem, but we know who to blame. And I'm tired of feeling it like the rest of the game. Teeth are ripped. Yo, yo, yeah, teeth are ripped. Yum, yum, yeah. Chemicals in your food. Eat the ribs.
Yum, yum, yeah.
Now don't you think that that's rude? Oh, eat the ribs.
Yum, yum, yeah.
You're listening to Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Today we're going to bring you an interview with Professor Morvin Long, who's former Fulbright scholar in Vietnam last year. He was on this show last year talking about Vietnam. And today we'll bring you another interview with Morvin Long on the situation in Vietnam today. And so we asked him what it was like in Vietnam today. What is the situation like in Vietnam? In terms of civil society?
Well, it's a complex question. I mean, it depends on, you know, who you're talking about. In Vietnam, of course, you know, because of the reform since 1989, you have a very big gap now between the rich and the poor within a very short time, let's say 15 years. The top quintile now controls about 45 to 47% of all the wealth, and the bottom quintile controls about 8%. Has only about 8%. So that's a very big gap in a very short time.
What's the average? You say the top people, then how much do they make?
It's difficult to know because some people may make, you know, a couple of million a year or even more. But for example, I mean, even the average people in Hanoi, you know, I mean, you know, average make about $1,000. But if you go just about 20 miles north or south or west of Hanoi, then people make only about $300 a month. And so, I mean, not only do you have the gap between the rich and the poor, you also have a gap between the urban areas and rural areas. And part of the reason for this is that the government, since the reform, so-called free market reform, or whatever you said, has cut almost all kind of subsidies to poor people. You know, I mean, also because of corruption or special privileges given to party members, sons and daughters of party members are getting way ahead of ordinary people. And that creates tremendous tension within the society. So you have, you know, a lot of demonstrations, you know, almost every day. You can see that in Hanoi, but especially in Ho Chi Minh City and in the countryside, there are a lot of that, but, you know, it doesn't make it to the press. But if you are a researcher or if you know people in the countryside, and they can tell you that there are almost daily demonstrations.
It's not limited to the countryside because I thought the protests were in the rural areas, but it's in the cities also.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the cities, because the cities are seats of government, whether it's provincial government, or district government, or national government, and the people, you know, when to bring it to the authorities. And in Vietnam, there has been, you know, a long tradition of protest. And now that the government has very little subsidies to people, the government, in fact, has less leverage. So it's very difficult to tell them not to protest, you know. Recently, I think about 3 weeks ago, Nong Duc Minh, who's now the chief of the Communist Party of Vietnam, and, you know, he was a nice guy when he was the head of parliament, the National Assembly, as they call it in Vietnam. I said, there's just too much democracy in Vietnam. People are just demonstrating all over the place almost every day. But, you know, that gives you a sense of what's happening. That doesn't mean that there is, you know, I mean, too much democracy. What it means is that a lot of people are very frustrated, and they think that the normal channels would not, you know, would not get them heard. So that's why you have the demonstrations. And I think the demonstrations are going to develop into some kind of civil societies, because people will find out that they have to be organized, they have to use legal ways as well as march in the street. And so, you know, in a way, the reforms, you know, has created this gap, but in another way, you know, it brings about, you know, political reforms, I think, eventually, or, you know, confusion and riots.
You're right. You think also that it would lead to maybe the formation of groups of people, activist groups that would make demands?
Yes, it has only done that. There are quite a number of NGOs in Vietnam now, Vietnamese NGOs. People don't know about that, but NGOs that take care of poor people, take care of orphans, you know, elderly people, peasants, and so forth and so on. Small, you know, organizations. And, you know, it's like, you know, I mean, mutual aid programs or whatever, but eventually that they are the seats of civil societies. And in Vietnam, it's very difficult for the government to carry out repression. Of course, abroad, you know, I mean, you hear, you know, about 20 to 25, you know, cases of political prisoners, and people keep on talking about a few names. But, you know, there are very few political prisoners in Vietnam compared to surrounding countries. And part of the reason for this is that, you know, Vietnam just came out of revolution. And many of the retired soldiers and retired colonels, you know, are living in the countryside, very close to people. Some of the generals may live, I mean, many of the generals may live in the cities, but some of them are even in the countryside. And they are the leaders of the protests. And it's very difficult, you know, to carry out repression against us. You know, I mean, Thaiban, you know, you heard about Thaiban cases several years ago. It was basically, you know, veterans, you know, who organized it, and they organized the whole province. Yeah. And finally, the government, you know, I mean, could not do anything but, you know, to send people down and, you know, promise reforms and fire some of the local cadres and. Unlike in China, of course, in China you have, I mean, it's a different story. In China, repression is carried out very vigorously. In China, there every year now you have about 100,000 protests and demonstrations.
Executions there.
Executions there, but a lot of time, you know, what they have done is that, you know, I mean, and this has been written in the New York Times and other newspapers. They send them to mental hospitals.
So it's like Soviet Union before.
And, you know, 3 days ago, for example, in the New York Times had a story about a woman who organized peasants, you know, against local despots, and yet she was put into prison by the central government, because the central government is afraid that, you know, if it does not repress people at the early stage, you know, then, you know, it would not be able to control the demonstration. administration.
This is in China.
This is in China. So there's a contrast, you know. Yeah. But there's also similarities, because even in China, it's very difficult for the government to control the protest, and that's the reason why you have about 100,000 demonstrations, you know, a year in China.
Yeah.
The gap between the rich and the poor in China are even bigger than in Vietnam. Yeah.
There's an article called "The General Retires." That seemed to show that he was critical of things that were going on, but he felt like there was like a generation gap too, and there was stuff going on in the province or wherever he was retiring to, and.
Yeah, the general retires is a complex story. Basically, it's not just a generation gap, but it's also a gender gap. Mm. You know, I mean, he retires. He's faithful to some of the revolutionary ideals. His daughter-in-law, you know, is a go-getter, you know, and you know, she's very smart, and she goes out there and she, you know, I mean, makes money, and she despises him or, you know, his ideals, and so you have a conflict there. And so.
But was there was a hint also that he made changes, right?
Yeah.
He wanted reform.
Right. Yeah. Yes. A lot of people want reforms in Vietnam.
Yeah.
It's just the question is what kind of reform. And many of the people who are calling themselves reformers are basically very corrupt. I mean, they pretend to carry out reforms, but they spend a lot of money, you know, building things that are not needed, so that there would be kickbacks, for them. And I mean, almost, you know, every big project in Vietnam is, you know, I mean, an occasion for kickbacks and that kind of thing.
They must be seeing the people in parliament for that to happen.
It's different, you see. The party, you still have a party, and of course you have to be a member of the party to be a member of the government. So you have the party, the government, and the Congress, or the National Assembly. Right now, in Vietnam, actually people in the government are much more powerful because they control the money.
Mm.
Although the National Assembly, you know, I mean, control the purse. But you see, they lobby the National Assembly, and the National Assembly agrees to certain funds for certain things, and then these people would use the funds. So people who can use the money are more powerful, and they are basically people like ministers, heads of different institutes, and so forth and so on. I mean, last year when I was in Vietnam, I wrote about 20 articles on educational reforms in Vietnam, because, you know, they talk about reforms, but basically, as I said a while ago, I mean, that's not what they meant. That's just, you know, ways for them to get money from the taxpayers, from the government.
Is this rhetoric?
What?
Rhetoric.
Yes. For example, they said that, you know, we have to build more schools, more classrooms, because we don't have enough classrooms. Well, actually, you know, I mean, you know, in my computation, there's more than enough classrooms. If you cut class hours down, I mean, they have something like 40 class hours a week, for college students. That's too many, you know, I mean, class hours, you know, and people don't even have time to study at home. I mean, and so if you cut down the courses, like, you know, I mean, at the university level and graduate level, people have to take 43 subjects. Why 43 subjects? You know, I mean, you can take 10 subjects, that'd be enough. You know, or 15. And if you cut down the subjects, then you would cut down the class hours. You know, and if you cut down the class hours, then, you know, you have more classrooms available. Or, you know, they said, well, you know, we have to modernize now. This is the knowledge, you know, economy period, you know, so we have to have more computers. So, you know, I mean, last year they were thinking of spending something like 300 trillion dong, you know, I mean, that's a lot of money. So I made a computation, you know, for computers, you know, And that is if you divide the number of computers, the amount of money, you know, I mean, to all the high school, grade school, and university teachers in the entire country, each would have 10 computers, 10 expensive computers. What the hell for? You know, you don't need that many computers. But the point here is that you say, I mean, if you buy that many computers, then the department, the ministry, and other people would get a lot of, you know, kickbacks, and they would, you know, enrich themselves. So there are all kinds of schemes, you know, and so not necessarily, you know, all reformers are equal. And so you have to,
We're talking with Marvin Long, who's a professor of history of Asian studies at University of Maine. He's also the author of a study of the peasant revolts in Vietnam history. This is Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. His book, Professor Marvin Long's book, is Before the Revolution, the Vietnamese Peasants Under the French, and it's now been reissued in paperback by Columbia University Press.
How about in terms of how would you keep track of money that people are taking on their own? Are there tax accounting procedures or income growth procedures that sort of keep track of corruption like that?
It's very difficult. There's no system there. It's, you know, I mean, every department has an accounting office, but you know, because the accounting office belongs to the department, it's you know, usually they cook the books. And as you and I know, you know, even here in this country, Anderson can cook the books. So I mean.
But in general, does the Vietnamese government, for instance, system, they look to China for what's happening economically, and then they try to model themselves after what happens there. Especially when the Chinese got into the World Trade Organization, and they feel they want to follow suit.
Yes, Vietnam, you know, is just like a younger sibling. You know, I mean, to China, China is a big brother. And so Vietnam over the years, you know, I mean, I would say over the years, you know, ever since the 20s, Vietnam usually mimic China. You know, there's a time lag, of course, you know, time lag, sometimes 10 years, sometimes 5 years, sometimes 6 years. And this has had disastrous consequences on Vietnam from the land reform of the 50s, you know, onward and so on and so on. Partly because, you know, I mean, China, you know, as a country, always done things in a big way. And sometimes because China is a big country, to get things moving, it has to have, you know, I mean, to do things like a military campaign, you know, this campaign or that campaign, the Great Leap Forward, the Great Proletarian, revolution, everything is great in China, it's done in a big way. And Vietnam, of course, you know, never done things in a big way like China. But when you take China, so you have different campaigns or different kind of thing. I mean, a small country like Vietnam can't afford, you know, to do things, you know, that big countries do. And Vietnam imitate China, and that's the problem.
Do you blame Ho Chi Minh was it his fault for the collectivization effort, or whatever he was doing? You know, after he tried to de-collectivize the farms, after China, was that the fault of his advisors?
Again, this is a complex issue. I mean, you know, first of all, I mean, China as a country forced Vietnam, you know, to carry out the collectivization, to be like China. So after 1951, you know, Chinese advisors began to go into Vietnam, and they really pushed collectivization. And part of the reason for that was not only to be like China, but also because they misread the situation in Vietnam. They wanted to get rid of the low-level cadres, because they thought the low-level cadres in Vietnam were members of the Nationalist Party, the Kuomintang in China and the Kuomintang in Vietnam. The thing is that the Kuomintang in Vietnam, you see, I mean, was basically wiped out by 1930. And so there were not too many members, and only a few members like Deng Huy Liu, you know, I mean, joined the Communist Party of Vietnam. And so the Chinese, you know, I mean, said, well, you know, we have a lot of, you know, Kuomintang people, you know, in our ranks, and we try to get rid of them. We use the land reform program to, you know, to do that, partly because they are usually from members of the landlord class. And so they try to do that, and that had disastrous consequences. I mean, you know, most of the supporters of Ho Chi Minh and Võ Nguyên Giáp, you know, were people from the rich peasant, you know, middle landlord class, and they were basically wiped out of the party. But then China also had a reason for that, because China wanted to weaken Ho Chi Minh and Giáp, and in order to strengthen the pro-China faction, you know, Lê Đức Thọ among them. And that was the thing, and this is the reason why you have tremendous friction between Lê Đức Thọ, Giáp, and Phạm Văn Đồng, and Ho Chi Minh, you know, for a long time after 1951. You know, Giáp was sent into exile, you know, after the revolution succeeded, in, or after, you know, Geneva. You know, and after 19, and then he was brought out, you know, to apologize for the land reform. But you know, they carry out, they continue with the collectivization anyway, and they again sent him, you know, and exile him to an island. Ho Chi Minh was basically totally isolated. And you know, the irony here was because of the American War that, you know, I mean, had these two guys released, because they needed heroes to govern and to mobilize the people, and so that's why Ho Chi Minh and Võ Nguyên Giáp had a comeback in 1964.
But later on, did he, was Ho just too sick to be in control at the...
No, he was not too sick, it's just that, you see, Ho, you know, from the very beginning, you know, I mean, he did not have an organization behind him. The organization was in the hands of people who live in Vietnam, because Ho traveled, you know, all over the place. And so, but, you know, people who live in Vietnam who had the organization, there are different groups, you know, and the group that really survived and you know, as, you know, with the group that live along the Chinese-Vietnamese border, and that's, you know, I mean, Lê Đức Thọ's group, Trường Chinh group, and that kind of those people, and those people were pro-China. And so Ho Chi Minh didn't, you know, I mean, had to rely on them. And Lê Đức Thọ, you see, for years until his death, controlled party organization, so he can put, you know, his own people into the party. But that was thanks to the land reform, because without land reform, then he would not have been able to control the party.
But why did they crack down on the South when they took over after liberation?
Yeah.
The Hang Ao forces, I guess, took control, right, of the South after 75. Was that a deliberate thing?
Yes. I mean, you know, I've written elsewhere, and, you know, I'm proving that, you see, I mean, by 1975, you know, I mean, Saigon would fall, and, you know, I mean, of its own accord, you know, you can just, anything would make Saigon fall. The thing is, and the NLF, of course, you see, I mean, had tremendous prestige and support of the people in the South, especially after the Tet Offensive. The NLF was terribly weakened as a result of North Vietnamese Hanoi's policies, you know, I mean, of three waves of attack, you know, in 1968. Can you stop for one second?
You're listening to an interview with Professor Ngoi Binh Long about Vietnam today. We continue the interview shortly after this musical break. Thank you. The International in Vietnamese. We go back to our interview with Professor Ngo Vinh Long. We asked what happened after 1975.
Yeah, it's a wonderful northern factions, you know, and this is later towards faction that controlled the party decided that, you see, I mean, they had to carry out a coup against the National Liberation Front, the NOF, the PRG. And that's why they rushed so many soldiers in very, very quickly. That's one of the reasons, and very, very quickly. And then when they got, you know, I mean, in there, they claimed that, you know, they were the people who liberated the South. But in reality, many, many of the cities in the South fell long before the first North Vietnamese troops arrived. Da Nang, for example, fell almost a month before, you know, the first North Vietnamese troops arrived. I mean, Da La, you know, I mean, fell to the local people, and 2 or 3 months later, you know, before you have a North Vietnamese, yeah. And but then, you know, when you know, after this military takeover, then, you know, North claimed, you know, lion's share of political power, and basically demobilized the Southern armies and dismantled the NOF. You know,
what happened to the NRF people? They got put in jail or no?
No, they were not put in jail. What you see, I mean, first of all, I mean, they were not given a share of power. You know, I mean, there were famous people, you know, I mean, like Trần Bú Kim, for example, I mean, he was totally evicted because he said, and wait a minute, you know, you don't have to, you know, reunify the country very, very quickly, wait for a few years, and, you know, mm-hmm. And they said that he was, you know, against reunification, they got rid of him. What others, General Trà, you know, I mean, they basically claimed that, you know, I mean, it was because of their strategy that took over, I mean, that one, and, you know, that's not true. And later on, he wrote a book, his memoir, you know, I mean, about that. But again, you know, it's very difficult. They didn't allow him to publish, so he published it, you know, I mean, secretly. But still, I mean, he didn't dare to say everything, you know.
So who designed the Tet Offensive's strategy? Was that the North?
The Tet Offensive, you know, strategy was designed actually as early as 1962, because they wanted to take over, you know, I mean, from Jin. But at that time, I mean, the argument was that, you know, you should not do that, because if you do that at that time, then the United States can use it as an excuse for bringing troops in, because there were American advisors there, but there were no troops. By 1967, you see, I mean, the NOF controlled most of the South, but North Vietnam was being bombarded on a daily basis. Because the United States, you know, I mean, this strategy was to, you know, I mean, force North Vietnam to make people in the South calm off the fighting, the attack. That's why they did that. And I have written this. I wrote a very long paper entitled The Tet Offensive and Its Aftermath, and talking about home history and what happened, you know, and that. And I delivered this paper in Vietnam in 1988, 20 years after the Tet conference, event. And I sent the papers there, you know, to Vietnam 2 months ahead of time. And so on the day of the conference, there were other Americans there too. This was the first Vietnamese-American conference. The gentlemen, there were a number of generals there, and the generals from the north as well as, you know, generals from the south. And the foreign minister was there, and Winker Tet. And it took them one whole day to discuss my paper. And, you know, the conclusion was that, you know, except for some minor details, you know, that was the best paper they have ever seen on Tet Offensive. And I knew what they would say that, because the reason for that is that by distorting history and distorting the record, they had created tremendous tension between the North and the South, making it, you know, very difficult for political integration. So my paper is an argument that, you see, at least if you want the real reunification, you at least should not distort history, or at least, you know, not that much.
What do you mean the tension between North and South?
Because, you see, when the North claims, you see, that it was responsible for all the successes and so forth and so on, and claim the lion's share of political power, then people in the South feel very frustrated and discouraged, you know. And even now, you see, I mean, you know, if you go to any foreign Vietnamese embassy in any foreign country, I mean, from the ambassador down to the smallest staff, they're all people from the North Vietnamese. Mm. You know, even, you know, when you go to the airport, you know, in Saigon, you know, most of the custom officers are people from the North, you know. And then after 1975, there was the carpet baggers for the North just descended on the South. And, you know, most of the key positions in almost every sector have been, you know, controlled by people in the North. And that makes it very difficult for true political integration and accommodation. And so I argue that, you know, if this kind of thing keep, as these things keep on going, at least the least thing you should do is just, to make the record straight.
But so there was a massacre there, right? I mean, in a way, during the...
Yeah, but not, there was a total of 710 persons killed for my research. Oh. Not as many as 5,000, 6,000, whatever, as the Americans claim at the time, and not as few as 400 as people like, some of the people in the peace movement here claim, like, what's his name? I wouldn't mention his name, but so I mean, there's a difference there, but not that big, 710 yeah. persons, and you know, I mean, and I came because I knew most of the people who were involved, and I interviewed most of these people, and yeah, and these people were killed at the, you know, I mean, at the last minute as they were moving out of the cities because they were afraid that, you see, their organizations in Hue were exposed, and if mm-hmm. they allow these people to live there, and you see, these people would, you know, carried out the revenge and the massacre against them. Yeah, so that was the thing. That's in the heat of the battle. But that's the single most bad decision, you know, by the other side during the war. But you don't have the same level of you know, terrorism or whatever, you know, as the Saigon side.
Bloodbath. In terms of party membership today, I guess people are still joining the party, right? I mean, it's going up supposedly. But do you think? But people join for other reasons than nationalism or whatever.
Most of them are opportunists. I mean, they join the party so that they can use the party as a cover for, you know, I mean, doing illegal businesses or, you know, promoting their careers. But they're mostly opportunists. And that makes it very difficult because, you know, I mean, you know, back, you know, to this, even as late as the 60s and 70s, even under the control of people like De Litoire, who was very partial, most of the party members, you know, were exemplary people. I mean, you know, and I've been back to Vietnam, you know, for I mean, almost every year for 15, 16 years now, interviewing a lot of people and looking back, I said, you know, yeah, I mean, from north to south, most of the cadres, you know, were honest, good people. And then, you know, I mean, after the war, I mean, some of them, you know, I mean, a lot of opportunists came in, opportunists, both in the north and the south. In the south, they call them Cách mạng 30 tháng 4, which means April 30th revolutionaries, you know, and you have a lot of these people like Jiang Zemin. And then, you know, I mean, they promoted themselves and became wealthy and rich. And that, you know, got other cadres to say, hey, you know, I mean, you know, they can do this, why can't we do that? You know, I mean, we would be losing out if we remain, you know, pure and honest. And so, I mean, you know, I mean, the party became more and more corrupt. And this is the irony because, you know, as you have more opportunists or corrupt, you know, cadres, and as you have only have one party left, you know, then it's very difficult for the party to control it, you know. I mean, how can you clean yourself? That's very difficult. And if you clean yourself, you know, you just fire, I mean, a few of them for, to make examples, but you just can't get rid of 60 or 70% of your party, you know, members, because if you do that, the party will weaken, and, you know, and so it's a very difficult thing. In the past, you know, even in the north, you know, you had three parties, you see, I mean, you had the Democratic Party, and you had the Socialist Party until 1980. You know, when they dismantled them, and that was a mistake. They should have allowed these parties to remain, and then when you have, you know, I mean, disaffected cadres, you know, this, you know, who criticize the party, whatever, they can join the other parties. But no, you know, you have tremendous infightings, you have factional disputes because you don't have, you know, outlets. And so I have recommended, you know, over the years that, you know, the fatherland, for example, you know, should, you know, be allowed to operate as a party, you know, as a voice, you know, for the people, because that's what it's supposed to be, instead of, you know, I mean, a place where, you know, I mean, you know, discarded members of the party, you send them there, you know, and say, you know, you go over there and keep quiet, you know, something.
How about this election recently? They announced some independent entrepreneurs to run, business people, whatever. Are those a separate party group now?
No, they're not. Yeah. Now they say that, you know, if you are, you know, I mean, outside of the party, you can run, but just for show, you know, just a few. Just like in China too, you know, they said that you can run, you know, I mean, even if you are not a party member, right? But, you know, just for some insignificant, you know, posts or whatever. And when you have 2 million cadres in Vietnam or 43 million in China, it doesn't make a difference if you have a few independent people. That's not going to make any significant change.
So is there a trade, do you support the trade agreement and what's your views on that?
Well, the trade agreement with the U.S. is quite tough on Vietnam, you know, I mean, especially because the United States, for example, in terms of, you know, I mean, agricultural products, the United States, you know, I mean, want the market to be open, you know, for American agricultural products without tariffs and so forth and so on. And yet the United States subsidizes, you know, I mean, American farmers, you know, I mean, up you know, to their noses, or, you know. And, you know, when the richest country on earth subsidized, you know, its farmers, you know, as much as that, then how can a poor country like Vietnam or China, which do not subsidize the farmers at all, they tax the farmers 10% or 12% a year, then how can they compete? So that's going to cause more problems, you know, I mean, for both countries, because, you know, I mean, the poorest elements in both countries are peasants. So, when, you know, maybe exports, you see, I mean, not yet in the case of Vietnam, you know, but in China has exported a lot, and, you know, 43 to 45% of Chinese export go to the United States. And so China, you know, needs the American market, you know, and for this export, so China can make the concessions and hopefully use the profit, you know, from its exports, you know, to subsidize farmers. It hasn't done yet, not yet, but it can. In the case of Vietnam, Vietnamese agriculture exports, you know, even in the best years, are not that much.
We're talking with Professor Marvin Long, a historian, about Vietnam. This is Sylvester here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI.
It's mostly agricultural stuff, right?
Right now, it's mostly agricultural stuff like, you know, almond, rice, coffee, and things like that.
Shrimp, they make.
You know, some money there. But with coffee, for example, I mean, Vietnam is now the biggest exporter of coffee in the world. And because Vietnam is the biggest exporter of coffee in the world, and Vietnam keep on exporting more, Vietnam has, you know, I mean, had a tremendous effect on world prices. I mean, world prices of coffee in London now is about half of what it used to be 2 years ago. And a lot of countries in the world, you know, I mean, tell the Vietnamese to cut down, you know, I mean, on the export. And the Vietnamese say, well, this is a market economy, you know. A lot of people are very angry at them, say, you know, Vietnam used to be a socialist country, and now, you know, it's, you know, it has this kind of thing. So a lot of people, you know, I mean, capitalists, other people say, hey, you know, good boy, Vietnam, you know. But that's not how you play, you know, as an international.
So if Vietnam joins the WTO, then would the U.S. be still able to subsidize its farm industry?
Yes, because, you see, I mean, you know, the United States, this is the biggest, you know, I mean, thing. I mean, recently, I don't know if you saw that or not, several days ago, the Bush administration increased subsidies to its farmers, and this is something like $180 billion in the next few years. It's a lot of money. And so, I mean, you know, its trading partners, you know, Europe, you know, and other countries are very critical of the United States. Even the World Bank is critical, saying, you know, I mean, if you really want, you know, poor countries, agricultural countries to develop, you know, I mean, you shouldn't do this because you are destroying them. Because, you see, there's no way any other country in the world can compete with American farmers now. But that's what the United States is doing, in spite of the fact that it's a member of the WTO.
But I thought the WTO is really saying you have to fair play or whatever, equal playing field, no?
That's what they're saying. So they say that you cannot subsidize export. The United States says that, you know, we are not subsidizing our export, we're only subsidizing farmers at home.
The growth of the... growing the stuff.
This, yeah, I mean, it's just, they're just a bunch of hypocrites, that's what they are. I mean, you know, and all these free marketers, you say, yeah, the biggest hypocrites of all. I mean, so, I mean, and the WTO, I mean, eventually it will be a more democratic, you know, grouping, but it's now controlled by the big countries. And even the big countries don't agree with themselves, as I said, you know, I mean, the Europe and America are now fighting over this farm subsidies thing.
Yeah. When I talked to you before in Hanoi, you were saying that the WTO could become a platform where the small countries could join forces to protect their interests against the Western powers. Yeah. Do you still believe that?
Yes, because, see, for example, I mean, the bilateral treaties between the United States and Vietnam is tougher than the demands of the WTO. The bilateral trade between China and the United States is tough for China than, you know, demands for WTO. So when you get into the WTO, then you see you can use the WTO to negotiate the United States and you and our members of WTO. So I mean, you know, our former agreement with you are much tougher than WTO, so you have to lower your expectation or whatever. And WTO, of course, is also a multilateral organization, so it's easier to negotiate in that kind of environment, you know, when you have 100 countries or whatever. But when you negotiate directly with the United States or directly with Japan, then you are a weaker country, then they can just run rough shots over you.
Even tougher, more tougher on Vietnam.
Yeah.
And there's more conditions on Vietnam.
More conditions, tougher conditions. So in a bilateral situation, when, you know, I mean, you deal with a giant, you have to make concessions. But, you know, in a more multilateral thing, then, you know, I mean, a giant, you know, may have to give in to 100 Lilliputs or whatever, you know, I mean.
But so how about all these protests in the sense you had all those anarchists, whatever, free trade people, or anti-free trade, whatever, they're anti-pro, but anyway, the people that protest the WTO, they're all wrong, right?
No, they're not all wrong, but you see, a lot of these people are single-issue people. You know, I mean, for example, some of the people who protest up to you are American labor. American labor, you know, I mean, for example, they're all for themselves. They're not really for, you know, laborers elsewhere, you know. And then, you know, when you talk about environmental people, of course, you see, I mean, you know, you should have environmental standards. But you see, I mean, if you impose American, you know, European environmental standards on poor countries like now, then it makes it very difficult for these countries to compete, because it's much more costly for them to put in, you know, on the mechanisms and so forth and so on, you know, I mean, to make the environmental standard, you know, at the same level of the United States and Europe, which, you know, I mean, have had, you know, 50 years, you know, I mean, jumpstart before them. And so a lot of these people, I mean, impose their standards, and it shouldn't be that way, you know. So why we are for environmentalism, why we are for, you know, working people, you should have some kind of international kind of a thing. And
but labor standards, should labor standards be imposed elsewhere? Like, should there be sweatshops in Saigon, whatever, you know, making Nike shoes or...
You have sweatshops here. You know,
yes, sure.
So of course you say, I mean, you have to make Nike improve its standards, and, you know, and it's true that, you see, because of protests in Vietnam and so forth and so on, Nike is doing a little bit better now. But you should not, you know, impose the same standards you have in the United States on Vietnam or other countries, because then they cannot compete.
Nobody can go buy the shoes.
Nobody can buy the shoes, you know, and then you see, I mean, at the same time that you drive them in droves out of the countryside, because, you know, I mean, your farm subsidies make your agricultural exports cheaper, and then you want to make your manufactured products, you know, in those countries much more expensive. Those people cannot buy them, and people abroad cannot buy them, so, you know, there's no way for the displaced labor to be employed, you know, so...
Do you see Vietnam is becoming like India or something? Like, you know, a lot of the U.S. The computer stuff is done in India, I suppose, even the software consulting and all that stuff. Given the people who are really, you know, hardworking and all that, and into computers and more computer literate, becoming more computer, do you see that as becoming that kind of a function in the world economy? Or?
There are many Vietnamese software companies which are now having, doing quite well. and they are trying to imitate India, but I don't think we should do that. I argue in Vietnam, you know, in Vietnam many years that you should not try to, you know, put so much money into what's called, you know, the IT, you know, industries. It's a mistake, you know. I mean, if you want to do it, you know, as small companies and so on, it's okay. But, you know, when you know, let's take the case of India. You know, India, you know, is said to be very successful, but with a recent slump, you know, tens of thousands of software engineers, you know, I mean, from India who work here in this country, you know, are unemployed and have to be sent home and so forth and so on. And the money that you put into this kind of thing, it costs about $200,000 to train a software engineer, you know, even in Vietnam or India, and sometimes even more. And then, you know, what do? You allow them to go to the United States or Europe, you know, to serve, you know, for foreign companies at the expense of the peasants and other people in those countries, you know. So Vietnam, I mean, and it would create, I mean, kind of islands of, you know, so-called, you know, high-tech development in a sea of poverty-stricken, you know, people, and that should not be done. I think what you should do is just give everybody an opportunity for a good, fair education. And then, you see, I mean, if the foreign companies want to make use of people that have good education, then they can train them for a specialized purpose, like the the IT industry, high-tech industries, or whatever. But poor governments should not spend a lot of their budget, you know, just training people for foreign companies in this way.
Should the education be free then?
I think this education should be free for at least up to the ninth grade. And then, you know, after that, you see, then, you know, and people can pay some for senior high school. When you get to the university level, if people do not have money, governments can give scholarships. What happens in a lot of poor countries right now, Vietnam included, is that the pyramid has been reversed. It's upside down. I mean, they subsidize university students, you know, I mean, almost in every way, but they cut budgets for grade school and high school. 45% of the entire national budget for education in Vietnam goes to the universities, and that's wrong. It should not be that way. It should be something like 80% for grade school and high school, and 20% for university.
What is it here in the U.S.?
In the U.S., I don't know. It's difficult to say because in the U.S. you have the state schools and you have private schools and so on and so on. So the government, there's not, you know, the Department of Education here in this country give only a few grants here and there, but, you know, the government does not, you know, use that much budget. So it's very difficult to complete.
But here they subsidize. Public schools are free here.
Public schools are free here.
Yeah.
And public schools are free here partly because of the of taxes from the local level, not from the national government. But, you know, I mean, the system here is wrong. It's wrong because, you know, I mean, you know, rich communities have better grade school, better high schools. Poor communities, you know, have poor schools because, I mean, it comes from the local tax. I mean, the government should jump in and make it, you know, a national government, a state government, you know, make it so that is every community, no matter how poor, should have the same, you know, quality of education, you know. And in Maine, for example, I mean, the very first thing that the state government cuts is the educational budget. You know, even for college, for universities here, our budget here at the University of Maine is cut drastically this year, 6%. And in the early 90s, you see, I mean, our salaries were frozen for, you know, about 5 years. Now, I joke at that point, you know, I said that, you know, mainly, you know, I'm in knows that, you know, educated people usually leave the state, so they want them to be uneducated so they can stay and pay taxes. And it's not true, you know.
Yeah, actually, California, they cut my salary like 3% in the early 90s. And all the faculty had to, and the faculty too, had to give up money. So and this year's bad, especially, also. There's less money to from the state to the schools. But when did they stop this free public education? Was it after 89, 80?
Yeah, slowly, you know, but they stopped it for, you know, almost for good, was, you know, several years ago. Yeah.
The how about in terms of why did they let you invite you to come back then to give talks and all that? Was it did you ask to come back or did you ask to come back or did they invite you or both?
Well, I usually don't ask to come back, but you know, I mean, I just go there, you know, to do research or to visit or whatever. But you know, different times ago, you know, different people from, you know, in the government invited me back for conferences or different projects or whatever. And in 1979, for example, I was invited by the Prime Minister of Vietnam to go and work and take a look at the collectivization program, the cooperatives, and to see what was wrong. And, you know, because I suggested that it should be seriously reformed. And when I studied that for nearly seven months and talked to them privately about the problems, which basically, you know, had to do with the party structure and so forth and so on, you know, led it to threatened to imprison me, and then I was banned from Vietnam until 1986 when they carried out the reform. Then in December of 1986, I said, okay, you can come home again. And partly because a lot of people said, well, he was victimized. He was the first one, you know, I mean, at least from abroad, who publicly said it's wrong for a country to do that, and we banned him from coming back. And how can we believe that we seriously carry out reform when we don't allow him to come back? And so, as a result of my track record, you know, I mean, you know, for sincerely wanting to help the Vietnamese people, although, you know, I mean, yeah, some of my analyses can be quite grating to a lot of people there, they, you know, have allowed me to go back and do what different things. Yeah.
But then in terms of U.S. government, they gave you a Fulbright. Yeah. So that, you weren't surprised at that?
No, I was not surprised, partly because, you know, there has been changes in policies over here. Of course, a lot of people here in this country, especially people in the Vietnamese communities, have wrongly called me a communist or whatever, and, you know, it's easy to label somebody that kind of way. But, you know, I'm a complex person. And some of the people in the state government in the past said, you know, he's a muckraker. And I think that's in a way, that's true. That's a true description. So it shows that they understand, you know, where I am. And in what I was proposed to do when I applied for Fulbright was very useful for Vietnam and the United States. And I'm, you know, frankly, one of the best people, you know, for those subjects. And so I think the State Department and Fulbright people, I mean, chose people because of their qualification. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, it proves that this government, you know, I mean, can tolerate people more, you know, not always, but you know, at different times of different political opinions, but who can be very useful.
That was an interview with Professor Marvin Long, former Fulbright scholar in Vietnam last year, and now a professor, has been a professor at University of Maine in Orono, and the author of a book about Vietnam peasant revolts from Columbia University Press, now in paperback. This is Dan Tsang signing off for Subversity. Today there's a protests at Long Beach City Council starting now at 5 o'clock. Item 29 on this council's agenda is a report on the prosecution of anarchists in Long Beach. So if you're interested, there's a gathering there right now at City Council in Long Beach. if you're from in the area. This is Dan Sung signing off for Subversity here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.